I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson. In a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how the American Empire and National Security State operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. On this edition of the program, we're going to be discussing some of the past foreign policy beliefs of Joe Biden, particularly his support of Plan Colombia and the war on drugs with Jeremy Kuzmarov of Covert Action magazine. This conversation is going to reveal a great deal about our involvement south of the border in Colombia and the consequences of it, which, needless to say, are harrowing. All that and more on this edition of Parallax Views. And now on to the conversation with Jeremy Kuzmarov of Covert Action magazine. Welcome to Parallax Views, Jeremy Kuzmarov of Covert Action magazine. Jeremy, how are you doing? And did I pronounce your last name correctly?
Yes, Kuzmarov. And yeah, I'm doing very well. Thank you. Thanks for having me on the program.
Well, I really wanted to have you on the show because I'm very excited to hear about the relaunch of Covert Action magazine. For my listeners that are unfamiliar, what is Covert Action?
Well, Covert Action was founded as Covert Action Intelligence Bulletin in the 1970s by Philip Agee, who was a CIA whistleblower, who wrote the book Inside the Company. And it was
quintessential reading, by the way, for my listeners. Quintessential reading.
Absolutely. And, you know, Agee had served in Latin America, and he was horrified by the torture of U.S. trained police in South America, and basically felt that the U.S. government was serving U.S. corporations' interests, you know, in Latin American countries and allying with the far right or regressive elements in those societies and supporting dirty wars against the left. So the magazine was intent on exposing CIA operations around the globe and even, you know, naming CIA agents who are participating in atrocities around the world. And Covert Action magazine, it was relaunched in the last year by Philip Agee's son, Chris Agee. And with Lou Wolf was one of the original founders and editors for Covert Action. It was then Covert Action Bulletin. But he's still alive. He's, I guess, late 70s, early 80s now. But he's assisted with the relaunch. And there's, you know, I guess, a new generation, new team. But, you know, it's a webzine, and we're growing. And, we're trying to, continue the legacy of Philip Agee and exposing, covert operations around the world. And also, at a certain point, the magazine branched out to not just focus on covert operation, but to provide critical analysis of U.S. foreign policy and the connection with domestic policy and critical analysis of U.S. politics, with mostly focus on foreign policy. Because, the media coverage, even alternative media, there's can at times focus more on domestic issues. So we focus more on foreign policy issues. And we try and present perspectives from the global south that viewers or readers here in the United States don't get exposed to.
And I was going to add, I think that Covert Action has really great pedigree. There's been some great people involved over the years. I think William Blum was involved when, rest in peace, by the way, and people like Ron Ridenour, lots of great authors. Peter Dale Scott has
a new article out that he co-authored with Aaron Good. So you have a lot of great stuff going on at Covert Action Magazine right now.
Absolutely. Thank you. Yeah. And we've had some coverage like of these, you know, color revolutions in Belarus and Eastern Europe. We've had articles on Africa. We had an article on the JFK assassination. These are the kind of topics we try and cover, and we try and cover all regions of the globe. And yeah, to publish authors like Peter Dale Scott, who's really provided probing analysis into the so-called deep state and intelligence agencies throughout his career. So we're happy to publish an article by him.
So in regards to your work, you've written a few books, Obama's Unending Wars being one of them. And right now at Covert Action Magazine, you're working on a series about Joe Biden. What do you make of Biden getting into office? Do you think this was better than having another 4 years of Trump? And what do we have to watch out for with Biden? Should we be concerned about some things?
Well, we did have an op-ed where we did give support to the kind of lesser evil argument. Unfortunately, yeah, I think Biden is slightly better than Trump. You know, Trump is just the bottom of the barrel and, you know, putting the U.S. on a slide to fascism or some form of fascism and, you know, supporting white supremacy and, you know, denying science and denying climate change. So, you know, I think it's a sad reflection of the state of American politics that we felt you had to vote for Biden in this election because, I mean, we're under no illusions about Biden. He's very conservative and he's done some terrible things throughout his political career. He's allied with corporate interests. Yeah, he evolved into a neoconservative. He's corrupt. You know, we have a series, the fifth part of the series deals with Ukraine. And there's a lot of corruption in his dealings in Ukraine. So we're under no illusions about Biden. Trump was just so awful.
I wanted to ask real quick, if I could, about Trump. I think there's been this conception of Trump as being more anti-war or not wanting to be as involved with U.S. interventions. What do you make of that? Because I feel like that's not really the full story, but maybe you'll disagree. I don't know.
No, I agree with you. I had a piece, I don't know if you saw my piece grading Trump, and I gave him a D minus. And I said right off the bat, and the only reason I didn't give him an F is kind of half facetious that he didn't start any major wars, but he perpetuated a lot of the wars. He expanded the drone war. He sustained record military budgets. He invented a new space command. He promoted this military worship and created these kind of military rituals around some of his speeches, which is reminiscent of totalitarian or fascist states. I think he was very pro-military. It's just, occasionally he would give off the impression that he was against wars. I think that was more because he was attuned to the political climate in the country. I mean, I think most of the American public is tired, whether they're conservative or Democrat or what, they're tired of endless wars and all the money that goes into the military. And Trump understood that. So he would occasionally make statements that would give the impression he was something of a isolationist or he was going to end the wars. But really, he did little concretely to end the wars. I mean, look at Afghanistan. It didn't end. And, you know, he dropped the mother of all bombs on Afghanistan. So he didn't really do very much to end the wars, but at least he didn't start any new major ones.
So then in regards to Joe Biden, where do you want to start with regards to his foreign policy history? As you said, you have a series going. I guess the first part was dealing with his ramping up of the war on drugs. Maybe you can give some background on Joe Biden and his view of the war on drugs, which really started picking up a lot in the Reagan era.
Sure. And yeah, Biden, was kind of a guy out of the early 60s. You know, he was kind of before the counterculture. He came of age before that. And I think he's more a guy of the 1950s, you know, we call it kind of square. I mean, he basically in the 60s, you know, he was a little older when the counterculture set in. So he was never part of the countercultural movement. He was never part of the anti-war movement against the Vietnam War. He got a deferment. I think initially he was supporting the Vietnam War. Eventually it came to oppose it. But he does recount in his memoirs, like he was a law student at the University of Syracuse University. And when some students occupied the chancellor's office to protest the Vietnam War, he allegedly called out. You know, he was with a group of friends going for lunch. And he called out, "Look at these assholes." You know, and he said that he never wore tie-dyed shirts. So, I mean, I think his attitude toward drugs and, you know, the war and stuff and politics were shaped by the, you know, the ethos of the 1950s. And then when he campaigned for the Senate the first time in 1972, although he presented himself as kind of the candidate of the younger generation because he ran against a World War II veteran who had supported the Vietnam War, Boggs, Caleb, I think is the first name, Caleb Boggs. But, you know, Biden presented himself then as anti-war to draw the anti-war vote and the young people. But he also started railing against drugs at that point, the danger of drugs and the threat of drugs and calling drug dealers, you know, evil and we have to lock them away. I mean, this kind of rhetoric and basically calling for a military approach. And he was calling for an expansion of the international war on drugs. Actually, a lot of Democrats at that time were advocating the same position. Some had played up the addiction of American soldiers in Vietnam and were saying, "Oh, look at what drugs are doing in our army. We've got to end the Vietnam War, but we've got to stop the drug trade and, you know, fight the drug traffickers." That seems to have been Biden's position. So he was, even in the early 70s, supporting an escalation of the international war on drugs. And then he became a key figure as a senator on various committees, including the Judiciary Committee, in pushing for harsh forfeiture laws that enabled the government to seize property from suspected drug dealers, often in a very heavy-handed way. And in the 80s, he often even outdid the drug war guru, Ronald Reagan himself, with his anti-drug rhetoric. And he was sponsoring some of the major legislation of the 80s that, in hindsight, was extremely draconian, and advocating for things like wide-scale urine testing and harsh, you know, mandatory minimum sentencing and harsh penalties for crack cocaine, which we know is used more in the inner city and by African Americans. So it ended up causing the over-incarceration of blacks, you know, harsher penalties for crack and cocaine. So Biden was always behind that. And that's the kind of, you know, these kind of policies. And that's the backdrop behind the Plan Colombia he championed in the late Clinton years, major escalation of the drug war in Colombia and promoting more aggressive militaristic approach.
So for my listeners that are younger and maybe unfamiliar, what was Plan Colombia? Give us the details on that one.
Well, it was an expansion of earlier drug war programs, basically a plan of expanded military aid, quite extensive. It was a $1.3 billion program. About 75% of it was devoted to military aid, so beefing up the Colombian army and police forces to fight the drug traffickers. Some money was given for judicial reform and treatment or prevention program, but it was a small percentage of the budget. And the problem was is that the Colombian army was engaged in a war against the leftist FARC group, Fuerzas Armadas Revolucionario de Colombia, a left-wing guerrilla group kind of inspired by Che Guevara that had been fighting, you know, since the 1960s. And they claim that the FARC were drug traffickers or narco guerrillas, but really the major drug traffickers were hated the FARC because the FARC was promoting land reform and land redistribution, and the cartels were huge landowners, and they were all, you know, often allied with conservative elements and had a conservative political outlook. The FARC largely just taxed coca in some of their areas. So a lot of the Plan Colombia money really went to a war against the FARC and the leftist guerrillas. And that was a kind of ulterior agenda.
And just really diving deep into this, because you mentioned it briefly in the article, you mentioned the inflated rhetoric pioneered by Harry J. Anslinger, the head of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics. I guess for people that haven't really considered the war on drugs, you know, I think people look and say, oh, well, Biden wanted to take down the cultivation of poppy fields at one point and was, you know, pushing Turkey to do that. What would you say to people that support the war on drugs? I think younger people are less supportive of it. But what would you say to people that maybe don't understand the fallout from Anslinger and this war on drugs that has been going on for decades? And really, it's a war that will never be won.
Well, exactly. You hit the point. It's a war that will and can never be won because it is human nature. You know, unfortunately, there are many social problems in our society that lead people to despair and to take drugs. It's also part of human nature to seek altered states of consciousness. So you can't fight something that's in human psychology. And when there's a demand for drugs, somebody will meet that demand. I think the most effective approach is to treat drug issue as a public health problem, to fund treatment for people who seek and need treatment. But to think that we could fight it through eradication or militarization is an illusion. That has never been shown to be an illusion. And I think what you find in the international war on drugs is great hypocrisy because the again, what I was saying, like with the FARC, you know, they're claiming that the FARC are the narco traffickers. So a lot of the money is actually really just going to fight the FARC. And they're actually not the major traffickers. And some of those traffickers are allied with the United States government and CIA. And for instance, these paramilitary groups that got some of the Plan Colombia funding was kind of a paramilitary arm of the Colombian army. But some of the paramilitary leaders were involved with cocaine smuggling. So the policy was completely ineffective because you're actually aligning with some of the major trafficking groups and more fighting the leftist guerrillas. So the war on drugs is really screwed up on so many different levels.
Now, Biden played a big role in supporting Plan Colombia. Could you talk about the report he prepared and his involvement in really pushing for the U.S. Support of Plan Colombia?
Yeah, he was sent to Colombia because in the Senate, you know, Clinton was promoting the war on drugs as part of his, you know, because Clinton was this kind of law and order Democrat and conservative Democrat.
Well, there's that famous line, right, from Hillary Clinton where, you know, she famously said, what was it? They're super predators. We must bring them to Hill, referring to, you know, gangs and whatnot. But it was all dog whistles for the right, you know.
Yeah, and Clinton was more kind of Republican light, you know, most. And actually, I was just in Arkansas mentioning him. I was at the University of Arkansas to a guy who's, you know, part of the Democratic Party in Arkansas. And he said, oh, Clinton's a Republican. And I keep trying to tell these people the Democratic Party luncheons I attend, he was a Republican, but they kind of worship him there. So, and yeah, so Clinton really played up that issue. And, you know, Biden was a Clinton type liberal. And there were some, you know, a few people like Paul Wellstone stood up in the Senate against the Plan Colombia and against the war on drugs and militarization that was fostered by it. But, you know, Biden kind of shot him down and defended Clinton's policies. And yeah, he was sent to Colombia to write a report that I think became a blueprint for Plan Colombia. And he did a lot of interviews and, you know, he did acknowledge some problems in Colombia, like with the paramilitary groups that were committing human rights abuses. But he felt he promoted the idea that more American aid would lead to better human rights outcome. And, you know, U.S. military training could promote human rights standards in the Colombian military. I think he was adopting that position. And he was generally, yeah, supporting Plan Colombia and arguing that it would, you know, help eradicate the drug trade and kind of turn the corner. And he was praising the Colombian police, even though the Colombian police were really corrupt.
And I was going to say, you even mentioned that Biden's campaign ads from this time period, he was calling drug dealers potential killers who need to be tracked down the way we track down serial killers. You write, the drug trade, in his view, was as much a threat to the international security of the U.S. as, quote, anything the Soviets are doing, and should be treated as a, quote, national defense problem requiring military solutions. So he was really committed to this issue, and he urged Congress in the report he prepared to quickly approve President Clinton's request for supplemental funding. This seems like someone who was very dedicated to this war on drugs.
Yes, I think he was dedicated from the beginning of his political career through the 1980s, through this period. It was really one of the major issues that he took up and causes he took up. And yeah, I think he was on the wrong side of history.
Now, in regards to the views Biden held on Plan Colombia, did he view this as a success, a failure? What was his view?
I think he's viewed it as a success. He's been trying to brag about it. He bragged about it in various op-ed pieces and statements he's made while campaigning for the presidency. So, you know, it's one of these things he's proud of, but the record shows that it's really very ignoble. But he thinks it's a great success, but all the studies have found it's not. It didn't. Well, even Elliot Engel, before he departed, released a report, departed politics, who is the, I guess, head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And his report said that Plan Colombia was a failure in counter-narcotics, although Engel claimed in his report that it was a success as far as counterinsurgency, which basically admits that an underlying purpose was counterinsurgency. That's not how it was packaged. It was packaged purely as a drug war program, but Engel's report admits it was a failure. It failed to curtail the supply of drugs entering the United States, but he says it was a counterinsurgency success because FARC was diminished, and in 2016 they signed a peace agreement. But that is a questionable claim in itself, because there are a lot of human rights abuses carried out against the FARC and in that war, including false positive scandals where the army would kill people and try and claim they had killed FARC, but it was civilians they had killed. So it depends on your definition of success.
Well, I guess the real reason for Plan Colombia then was really to combat the FARC, brand them as narco guerrillas, even though, as you point out and have mentioned, they really were not directly involved in cocaine processing or trafficking, but they did tax the coca profits in their domain. But it doesn't seem like it was really about combating narco trafficking. It was about taking down the FARC because of their ideological beliefs and some of the things they advocated for. What did the FARC advocate for that the U.S. would have not liked?
Yeah, generally you're correct. I think the drug war often served as a cover for gaining congressional approval for military assistance or police assistance programs to more right-wing governments that served certain U.S. strategic objectives, but that the public wouldn't necessarily be too happy about that, because they were oppressive regimes with terrible human rights records like Colombia. And yeah, the FARC was promoting the redistribution of land and wealth. They were, you know, calling for taxing multinational corporations more, or nationalizing industry. So they were a threat to American corporate interests in Colombia, which were quite considerable. And some of the leftist groups would actually target multinational corporations with terrorist attacks, targeting like oil pipelines that they would try and sabotage. So it was corporate interests that were promoting Plan Colombia. And I explore, I think, a bit in the article, like Al Gore had connection with Occidental Oil. His family, going back to his father, had been funded by that oil company, which was a big supporter of Plan Colombia. And they, you know, were they hated the FARC.
Now, you also mentioned a character by the name of Carlos Castaño. Who is Carlos Castaño, and how does he tie into all of this?
He was the head of the paramilitary groups that did a lot of dirty work in the war against the FARC. and also at times targeted union activists, any left-wing political activists, because Colombia's had very high number of union activists killed. So, and sometimes they'd be hired by the big ranchers to go after, you know, farmers tried to organize for their rights. Big ranchers would pay them to intimidate or terrorize the farmers. But they also, you know, they were a wing of the Colombian army, and sometimes they carried out death squad operations. And they were indirectly or sometimes possibly directly getting funding from U.S. government agencies through the Plan Colombia and benefited from the military and police aid. But I think Castano was ultimately implicated in the drug traffic. Yeah, I think the statistics I present in the article is that like 80% or something of non-combatant killings were by the paramilitary groups, like those led by Castano. And yeah, he was ultimately indicted for major drug trafficking. They financed some of their operation clandestinely through the drug trade. So, and that gets the failing of the war on drug, because you're subsidizing groups that are major drug traffickers to fight the leftist guerrillas, essentially.
Yes, you write that Castano was close with the powerful, and I'm hoping I'm not botching the name here, but the Hanayo Montoya drug trafficking cartel, and was indicted by the U.S. Department of Justice in September 2002 and charged with trafficking more than 17 tons of cocaine. This is all really wild because it seems to really expose the war on drugs for what it really is.
Yes, and I think you find that pattern in other countries as well, where you find some of these major drug traffickers have been on the CIA payroll, or the U.S. may be subsidizing them, and you know, directly or indirectly, that they're allied with the far right or political right in countries where the U.S. Is ultimately supporting and empowering the political right against the left. And yeah, some are major drug traffickers and criminals and criminal networks that the U.S. is indirectly funding. So how could the war on drug be successful when the U.S. is supporting directly or indirectly these kind of people and fighting people who have really nothing to do with the drug trade or very limited thing to do about it?
What's so telling is, you know, the U.S. government, spent what, $10 billion dollars on counter narcotics under Plan Colombia, and in 2016 Colombia remains the world leader in coca production, as you point out.
Exactly. And you know, it's talk about money going down the sinkhole. I mean, we have a lot of problems in this country. We have problems in education. We need a proper healthcare system. Our infrastructure needs upgrading. I mean, that's what the government should be focused on, instead of these quixotic crusades abroad that really are serving certain corporate interests. And it's really a reflection of a major failing of the American government in the last generation or two, failing its own people and causing harm to people around the world.
And you also have a subheading in this article, chemical warfare. I was unaware that this was an aspect of Plan Colombia. Could you detail that for my listeners?
Yes, I think that's one of the disgraceful aspects of Plan Colombia, is they were spraying the part of the strategy was to spray the farmers' fields. And often, you know, firstly, they would target, you know, more vulnerable farmers who were driven to grow coca because of poverty. And you know, some of the governments the U.S. supporting were horribly neglectful of various rural areas, so they have no way to make a living except growing coca. And then the spraying campaign, well, sometimes they didn't even spray the right field, or you know, the residue can affect neighboring, you know, whoever's living in that vicinity, because it could get into the water. You know, they spray these chemicals, and they're it's the kind of stuff they started doing in Vietnam with the Agent Orange. And I think it's variants of that made by the same company, Monsanto. And I think they were spraying grades that were not legal in the United States. And it got into the water supply and food systems of various communities and caused a lot of people to become sick. It caused animals to die. And it ravaged the environment of these communities and affected people's lives and even led to deaths.
A few more things in regard to this specific article. You mentioned a former special forces officer in Colombia, Stan Goff, What does he have to offer us in understanding Plan Colombia, and why did you feel it was important to include just a little bit of his testimony in this article?
Well, because Stan Goff, I guess, is a kind of whistleblower who was involved with these programs, but then came to speak out against them. And, you know, he was a military advisor in Colombia and some other countries. And he said, you know, the official line was that we're here to give counter-narcotics training, but really it was counterinsurgency, you know, Vietnam-style counterinsurgency. And, you know, he may have been in Vietnam. I'm not sure his personal history. But so, you know, he basically exposing that the war on drugs is a sham and that this is just a cover for a dirty war against the leftist guerrillas using Vietnam and promoting Vietnam style counterinsurgency tactics that resulted in major human rights violations.
If we could, how does this relate to the bigger picture of U.S. foreign policy south of the border? I mean, people know a little bit, at least peripherally, if not, more in depth about things like Iran-Contra. It seems like there were these incidents of the U.S. supporting death squads south of the border. What was this all for? And the big question, who benefits? Cui bono?
Well, that's a good question. Who benefits is a company like Occidental Oil and Drummond. This guy Drummond was the biggest he was the richest man in the state of Alabama. And he moved into coal mining in Colombia. And, you know, they're a major beneficiary of these programs because they don't like the FARC or they don't like union organizers. And the Colombian army and police, you know, are going after the FARC or they're going after leftists or union organizers. So, you know, it's really American corporate interests that are the big beneficiaries. And, you know, the so-called military industrial complex, the arms supplier, because I think there's a quote in that article that, you know, everyone who's in that business is getting in the Colombia game or something like this. So it's just, you know, Vietnam is over. The Cold War is over. How are you going to justify military intervention? Oh, war on drugs, you know, that keeps the profits churning for the arms makers and, you know, Sikorsky and Blackhawk and Lockheed Martin and these companies are supplying the arms. And then there are these some of the spraying was done by mercenary companies like DynCorp got involved in that. So those are the big beneficiaries. The losers are the Colombian peasants whose water is poisoned, their land is poisoned, and the growing displacement and violence in Colombia because of the war, and the progressive forces are being crushed by the right-wing government that's being empowered and bolstered by U.S. military and police aid. And, you know, a favorite of the U.S. for a while was Alvaro Uribe Vélez, whose brother was a rancher who ran paramilitary, I think, death squads. And Uribe himself was tied with the Medellin drug cartel. And I think now he's under house arrest for war crimes. And he carried particularly aggressive war against the FARC and was a right-wing leader whom the U.S. supported. So, you know, the beneficiaries are right-wing political groups and not the people of Colombia and not American because we're losing all our tax dollars to something that is a sham, really.
And, of course, Joe Biden has received money in his campaigns from these defense contractors that you mentioned. When we place this in the broader context, would you say that the U.S. foreign policy decisions made with regards to Colombia belong to a larger tradition of interventions in places like El Salvador, now what we're seeing with the aggressive stances of the U.S. when it comes to Venezuela? What is it about these countries south of the border of the U.S. That we're constantly really aggressing them?
Yeah, I mean, there's a long history that goes back, you know, to the 19th century, and the, you know, Rockefeller oil interests were often driving more expanded U.S. intervention with to gain access to oil and there was the building of the Panama Canal, which enabled the more, the better extraction of raw materials from Latin America to feed American businesses. And that was followed by the Roosevelt Corollary, the Monroe Doctrine, which basically gave added legal justification for the U.S. to intervene militarily to kind of have its way. So it's a pattern that goes back over 100 years of U.S. imperialism and the U.S. Attempt to gain advantage by exploiting the economies of Latin America and extract their resources. And,
colonialism.
The U.S. had a history of supporting dirty war, and that's why Philip Agee became a whistleblower, because the U.S. was allied with often the most repressive elements and conservative elements in so many Latin American countries, and supporting violent, sometimes death squad operations to prevent the political left from gaining power and working to try and redistribute resources and forge more independent economies from the United States.
Yeah, my apologies for interrupting you. It just seems like the legacy of colonialism, and also, what's interesting about this is, Biden, his view on Colombia has not changed in spite of everything. He considers it a keystone of U.S. policy in Latin America. What is Colombia like today that shows that this idea that it's a keystone of U.S. policy, why should that bother us when he says that? What is happening in Colombia at the present moment that should be disturbing to us?
Well, that should bother us because Colombia still has a very bad human rights record. The current leader of Colombia, Ivan Duque, is a protege of Alvaro Uribe Vélez, who sits under house arrest and was a hardline conservative allied with who had ties with the Medellin drug cartel. And Duque, there was a peace agreement with the FARC in 2016, but there have been violations by the government, and Duque may revive the war against the FARC. And there have been a lot of trade union activists killed in Colombia. In the past, they've set the record as far as Latin America, I believe, maybe even world record, I don't know, but it's approaching that for number of union activists killed. So there's impunity. There's never any punishment. It's usually these paramilitary gangs who have loose affiliation with the Colombian army, and they often have impunity when they carry out death squad operations or killings. So why should American taxpayer be giving our money to such an oppressive government? I think the progressive Americans and American citizens should be against that. We want to spend our money to develop our society and encourage, human rights and democracy in other countries, not to beef up the militaries of the governments with patterns of repression. But the reason that the U.S. supports Colombia is that Colombia has numerous U.S. military bases and borders Venezuela, and the U.S. is committed to overthrowing the left-wing government in Venezuela and defeating the Bolivarian Revolution, which is trying to forge more independent countries in Latin America from U.S. influence and promote socialist principles.
And we also have Biden coming out recently. He recognized Juan Guaido as the leader of Venezuela. He labeled the socialist president Nicolas Maduro a dictator, plain and simple. What's your response to that? What should people know about Juan Guaido, and why should that be concerning to us? Because you mentioned that at the end of the article.
Well, I think it's concerning because it's a pattern where the United States is ideologically committed to destroying socialist governments and commits many excesses and supports many unsavory leaders in trying to do that, and is really trampling on the sovereignty of Venezuela. Because Guaido was not voted in by the Venezuelan people, and I think is viewed as kind of a charlatan and opportunist in the region. And he has no standing as the leader of the country, but the U.S. is recognizing him, and Biden is recognizing him. And it's part of this agenda to try and undermine that socialist government. And it's a policy that goes back to when Hugo Chavez took over Venezuela and promoted socialism and nationalized some of the oil industry, and was trying to advance the Bolivarian Revolution build an alliance of Latin American countries that could forge more independent economies from the United States.
And Guaido himself is a right winger. It just seems so authoritarian for us to keep meddling in the affairs of South and Central America and to be hoisting up these right-wing figures who I really think their interests are not in the interests of the people of these countries.
I don't think so. Yeah, they're more because I think reports found that Guaido wanted to privatize a lot of Venezuela's economy that had been nationalized. And I mean, really, it's in the interest of multinational corporations. And unfortunately, our government is dominated by, most of the political figures, as you point out, get their funding from large corporate donors, wealthy corporate donors. And it's really in their interest to adopt an aggressive policy in Latin America to try and unseat leftist or progressive regimes. But it's not in the interest of the majority in the United States, nor certainly in those countries.
Now, in regards to your other pieces that you've written recently on Joe Biden, what do you think are the most important aspects of Biden in terms of foreign policy beyond what we just talked about with Plan Colombia that people may have forgotten or that aren't being covered extensively in the press right now?
Well, one I think would be Biden's connection with Avril Harriman, who was his mentor when he first came in the Senate, and I think one of his major political mentors. And Avril Harriman was a kind of big man of U.S. foreign policy who's considered in some history books as a major father of the Cold War. He was the founder of a Wall Street investment bank who lost out a lot of investments after the Russian Revolution. And he carried a vendetta against the Soviet Union that turned him into a hardline Cold Warrior who supported the Vietnam War. And so we could relate that to Biden's support for Juan Guaido and his aversion to socialism. It's similar to Harriman. And, Harriman, I think Biden is, the favorite son of the American political establishment and, the Council on Foreign Relations, which is considered Wall Street's think tank. So he's going to sustain high military, and he's already said that he's not going to cut the military budget. He may even have to increase it from the record levels of Trump. And, he's got a lot of his money from, he outdid Trump as far as donations from the the war industry. So I think, those of us in the progressive community, which I think is now the majority of the American public, wants less funding for the military and does not want to see more wars or the extension of current wars, has to be worried about Biden and should work hard to try and pressure them, try and pressure him and his administration on these foreign policy issues to reduce, and it may or may not be successful, but a big grassroots effort can have an impact. And that's, I think, what's needed, because with the urgent problem we have with the corona crisis, we need the government investing money in the American public and in addressing the economic fallout from the corona crisis, in revamping our healthcare system and bringing free healthcare to the country. But that becomes impossible when you spend billions of dollars on the military and, you're involved in all these dirty war operations, whether in Latin America, whether it's in Ukraine, because Biden's a big hawk on Russia. And he's been advocating for more military aid to Ukraine and more lethal military aid for a long time. And that war is still going on there. So I think that's what progressive force in America should be against. We want to forge better relations with Russia and China, de-escalate tension with the major powers, end proxy wars and bring down the military budget and spend the money on revamping our economy and developing a good public health system and preparing for the next pandemic.
Well, yeah, I mean, we're facing, many Americans, I should say, are facing evictions. We have a healthcare system that is not working in the middle of a pandemic. I just had a guest on saying that, the vaccine rollout has become something of a Hunger Games scenario. And yet there's still this push for more intervention overseas. You mentioned Russia. There's a lot of talk about a figure, Navalny, What is your take on the protests and Navalny?
Well, I'm concerned that this could be a color war, color revolution operation, because that's something Biden has supported throughout his career. He was a cold warrior, and then as a protege of Harriman, and then in the early 2000s, he supported these color revolutions, like in Ukraine, in Georgia, and in Belarus, where you have a pro-Russian leader in a country, and he may not be the best leader in the world, but the U.S. has its own agenda. They want to pry that country onto the Western orbit. They want to expand NATO in that country. So they support these kind of fake revolutions, or they co-opt, a pro-democracy movement and support a certain political candidate who's more of a kind of West, lackey, so to speak, of the Western interests. And that may be occurring in Russia. I mean, yeah, Putin's been in power in a long time. So there is genuine, unease or disaffection with Putin. But the danger is, on the other hand, Putin does have some real accomplishments. I mean, Russia's economy was restored in the 90s. Their economy was devastated by the rapid privatization programs that were ill-conceived and led to huge corruption and huge inequality in the gutting of the safety net. So their economy was ruined in the 90s. Putin's restored it to some extent. Now, there are a lot of internal problems in Russia. And yeah, after 20 years, people may legitimately want a new leader, and Putin showed some authoritarian tendencies. But the danger is that the U.S. Will exploit this and is pushing a guy like Navalny. They're maybe trying to create him as a hero because of this alleged poisoning, although it's not proven that he was actually poisoned. There are a lot of murky things about that poisoning and question marks, and Navalny's own story doesn't necessarily add up to him having been poisoned by Russia. So it's quite possible that he has some powerful foreign backers who are trying to support a color revolution to unseat Putin and bring in Navalny, who will be more pro-West, because Putin is a Russian. He stood more for Russian interest. He's restored certain self-respect for Russia, and he reclaimed the Crimea for Russia. One thing Navalny, I've seen, wants to do is, because Putin has restored Russian power over certain regions in Russia, and as a strong leader, he's kind of brought certain provinces into the Russian fold and asserted Russian power and control in those provinces. I think Navalny was calling for a weakening of the Russian Federation and giving more autonomy to certain regions. And I mean, there's a certain complexity to that issue, but at the end of the day, that will weaken Russia and will be to the interests of Russia's foes like the United States and Germany. So Russia is an oil producer, and there's competition with Russia over control over the oil wealth in Central Asia. The U.S. may want to try and impose a leader who will weaken Russia, whereas Putin, a pretty strong leader from a Russian point of view. So that's what's to be weary of. And Navalny is a shady character who in the past has appeared at far right-wing rallies and promoted a strong anti-immigrant rhetoric. So I think it's an illusion that he's this great liberal who will restore liberal democracy to Russia. But I think they're trying to cultivate that image and myth for him. As part of a broader political operation, perhaps.
That is something I wanted to touch on here. The thing that worries me about Navalny, and I have not really delved into the poisoning, I just want to look at his politics. He is extremely, extremely anti-immigrant. The level of Islamophobia, if you read some of his tweets and you get the translations, this is very disturbing stuff. His attitude towards Islamic immigrants, I mean, it is extremely violent, and it's not progressive in the least.
Yeah, and I mean, my own view is an anti-imperialist view, is that the United States shouldn't encroach on the sovereignty of other countries. And, we see the danger time and again. And, there are imperfect leaders in the world, but who's going to replace them? And the United States has its own agenda in opposing Putin. And yeah, they want to create this binary between the bad authoritarian Putin and the pro-democracy liberal Navalny. But as you suggest, that's a mere illusion. And Navalny may be worse in his attitudes on some of these issues to Putin, and may ultimately be a much worse leader for Russia and more of a patsy of the West.
So before we close out, I know we just have a few more minutes here. Is there anything you can say that you're hopeful for with the Biden administration? I know there's talk of, backing off of Saudi support or the U.S. support of the Saudi atrocities in Yemen. Do you think we're going to see a sort of shift when it comes to our involvement with the Saudis in Yemen, or do you think that's all talk right now?
It's hard to say. I mean, that is a step in the positive direction, you know, that the administration is renouncing support for that war and saying we'll cut ties to Saudi. I mean, there may be more covert ways and underhanded ways that the U.S. will ultimately support the Saudi regime. But I mean, I think that is one good thing. I think, at least the administration acknowledges science and, you know, is taking some measures against climate change, which is important. So on a couple things, it is a big improvement than Trump. So, but on certain things, I'd be worried, like with attitudes towards Russia and China seems to be falling the same way as Trump, or in some ways even more bellicose, like an attitude to Russia. So, and Latin America, it seems to be just continuation of the Trump policy, trying to overthrow the Venezuelan government and support Guaido. So we see some continuity and some change. I mean, again, I think a game changer could be if there's pressure on Biden, he may yield to that pressure. So I think progressives need to organize and try and push him in a better direction.
In that regard, you've written a new article that came out on January 30th entitled "How to Derail the U.S. Rush Toward War with China? Two peace activists suggest an answer." I always like to end on a positive note. So maybe you could give a very brief rundown of what that article is about and what it covers.
Great. Yeah. And I think those are the kind of constructive things we can do. How influential they'll be is not known, but it's a good effort. And yeah, that's a group. Michael Clare and Joseph Gerson are two researchers who found a new organization called, I think, Committee for Sane U.S.-China Relations. And it's a kind of antidote to Steve Bannon's organization, Committee on the Present Danger China, which is modeled after a Cold Warrior group called the Committee on the Present Danger, which was, I think, funded by military industries and the CIA and constantly promoted alarmist views about Russia during the Cold War and was lobbying for more military spending and Cold War arms buildup. And that's what Bannon's group is doing for China. And they promote disinformation and anything negative about China to stir up anger and hatred for China and to lobby for more aggressive military approach. And this organization, the SANE Committee, is an antidote to that. It's modeled after a disarmament group that was formed in the 50s after the Hiroshima bombing that was pushing for nuclear disarmament throughout the Cold War. And many of its members, I think, became part of the Students for Democratic Society, which opposed the Vietnam War. So this group, yes, promoting better relations between the U.S. and Russia and China. They have some, I was impressed by their website because they have some very practical proposals that could be followed, policy approaches that could be pursued, where the U.S. really is not, is not giving things up, is not acquiescing to any of China's designs, but a kind of practical approach to ratchet down the tensions and to, promote the ultimate goal of better relations and disarmament. And that's the goal. I was saying we want to channel our resources away from these huge military budgets and spending to address the needs of Americans in the time of a pandemic and an economic crisis.
Well, Jeremy, I want to thank you for coming on Parallax Views. Do you have any parting comments? I'm just getting the breaking news about a Russian court has sentenced opposition leader Navalny a persistent critic of Vladimir Putin, to more than 2 years in prison. That's from the New York Times that just came out about an hour ago. Any comments on that? And then could you also let my listeners know how they can keep up with your work and the work of Covert Action Magazine?
Oh, sure. Well, as far as the Navalny, this is kind of a saga playing out. Some of it is, the Russian government's actions are obviously appear to be heavy-handed and unjustified, and they may very well be. It's just, questions have to be raised as to, who Navalny is, and if there are certain outside interests that are, pushing support for him as part of a broader campaign to undermine the Putin regime and encroach on the sovereignty of Russia for the wrong reasons, to weaken Russia so that the U.S. could exploit more of the resources of the region. So that's what I think people have to think about in that case. And as far as, my work, covertactionmagazine.com is our website, and we're publishing several articles each week, and we're also open to new submissions. So if you have a good article idea, we're happy to receive it. And we want to expand our coverage of these, some of the issues discussed in this program and others related. And I should add, my email is if you want to contact me, jkuzmarov2@gmail.com.
Well, thank you again, Jeremy Kuzmarov, for coming on Parallax Views. Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Jeremy Kuzmarov of Covert Action Magazine. Be sure to check out the great work that Covert Action Magazine is doing. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter @ViewsParallax or by email @ParallaxViewsPod@ProtonMail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Catherine, Nathan, Holland, Mark, Chase, Zach, Ted, Gratz, Martin, Gary, Emilia, and Mickey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, consider joining those listeners in supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers of my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. There is also a $1 tier and a $5 tier. Any amount will help. Your support is what keeps this show going. So if you appreciate the work I do, $1, $5, $10, $15, doesn't matter. Please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. Again, that's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. If nothing else, if we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight. With no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.